from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It looks like the Taliban is not out of business just yet. At least 3 U.S. troops and 9 Afghan soldiers and policemen were killed in the last week in fighting that marked a new level of intensity for post-war Afghanistan. The government of Pakistan says it has pacified its side of the border, but reports from the ground have the Taliban resurgent, operating in the open, crossing aggressively into Afghanistan to conduct raids. The Pentagon, with its hands full in Iraq, downplays the renewed Taliban threat. But reporters in the region say that the threat is real and growing. Tonight, On Point, a resurgent Taliban and a return to battle in post-war Afghanistan. We begin in Lahore, Pakistan. Ahmed Rashid is a reporter for the Far Eastern Economic Review and author of the book Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. I asked how he is interpreting the recent clashes between U.S.-led forces and Taliban fighters.
I think certainly it's the most serious fighting that has taken place since the defeat of the Taliban nearly 2 years ago. What is very significant about these present clashes is there's something like 1,000 Taliban now inside Afghanistan fighting American and Afghan government forces. And for the first time, they're standing and fighting, although they're being very heavily bombed by the Americans. And we've had these clashes going on for the last 10 days. In fact, more Taliban have come in from the Pakistan border, and they're trying to open new fronts against the Americans. Over the weekend, 2 Americans were killed in an ambush which was several hundred miles away from the main fighting zone. So that kind of shows there is a major Taliban offensive going on.
So the U.S. command at some point seems to describe this as a beleaguered Taliban. You may be describing it as a resurgent Taliban.
I think certainly it's a resurgent Taliban. We have not seen these kinds of numbers of armed men, obviously well supplied with logistics, with ammunition, being able to sustain heavy losses and heavy loss of material also, and still being able to stand and fight. Clearly, this is something completely new and something that American commanders and forces were probably not expecting.
Geographically, where are the Taliban strongholds now?
Well, most of this fighting is taking place in southern Afghanistan, which is now completely off limits to the United Nations and other aid agencies. Most of the Taliban are coming in from Pakistan, that is from the refugee camps, from the religious schools, which are in and along the border on the Pakistan side of the border with Afghanistan. In the past, they've been coming in small groups of 20 or 30 men, carrying out attacks and raids or ambushes, and then going back into Pakistan. This time, they seem to be coming back to stay.
I'm reading here a Washington Post story from just this morning, Ahmed. The headline is, Pakistan touts control of the border, and it quotes Pakistan officials telling journalists who are being flown over Pakistan that there's no Taliban problem here. They're under control. We have cracked down.
Well, I don't think that's the real situation. In fact, over the last couple of months, with all this Taliban activity, we've had some very harsh words from President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan and Afghan leaders, also from American officials, Zalmay Khalilzad. President Bush's special representative to Afghanistan has said that Pakistan is not doing enough to crack down on the Taliban. And there seems at least the government here is still trying to paint the picture that actually these Taliban are not in Pakistan, but they're all based in Afghanistan. Well, that's not acceptable because, I mean, we've known for a long time that Taliban have not been in a position to base themselves in Afghanistan. They can't do that because of the patrols of the Afghan forces and the American forces and the aerial surveys, etc. Clearly, they've been here and that they're crossing the border into Afghanistan.
What's behind the renewed Taliban activity then?
There's an enormous amount of support now coming from various elements in Pakistan. There is the accusation from the Afghans that the Pakistan military intelligence is behind it. There are accusations that the religious parties and extremist groups in Pakistan are also supporting the Taliban, the drugs mafia. There's a whole kind of range of elements who really would benefit from seeing continued chaos in Afghanistan. For example, I mean, the drugs mafia, this year, Afghanistan has once again topped the world and will be producing more opium than any other country in the world. Now, clearly, dealers, traffickers, and even growers have an interest in keeping this level of violence and uncertainty so that the central government is never able to stabilize and stop poppy cultivation.
And specifically to Pakistan official elements and maybe the Pakistan intelligence services, what is their interest in seeing an active, resurgent Taliban?
Well, Pakistani officials are talking about three particular criticisms that they have. The first is they say that India, the long-term rival of Pakistan, has established itself very firmly in Kabul and is exerting influence and is setting up consulates on the Pakistan border, and this is a threat to Pakistan. The second factor is that Pakistan says that the Pashtuns, that is the ethnic group in southern Afghanistan from which the Taliban come, and also there are large numbers of Pashtuns in Pakistan, the Pashtuns in Afghanistan have not had a fair deal in the present setup and are getting crushed by the former Northern Alliance, which backed the U.S. forces in the war against the Taliban. The third element simply is that despite President Pervez Musharraf's support to the U.S. in the war against terrorism, there's a lot of sympathy for the Taliban and militant Islam in the military and political circles. We should remember that the Northwest Frontier province, which borders Afghanistan, is right now being ruled by a provincial government which is made up of very extreme Islamic fundamentalist parties.
Ahmed Rashid, we've got 10,000 U.S. troops in Pakistan, 12,500 coalition troops in all, 5,000 in the new Afghan army. Is the U.S.-led effort there winning the peace in Afghanistan or not?
I think the opinion of most people over the last 1 year is a big no, and that's why we are seeing now the U.S. has said that in the next couple of weeks it's going to announce a new aid package of up to perhaps $1 billion and start major reconstruction. What we have not seen over the last 2 years is the promised nation building, the promised reconstruction of the infrastructure of the country, not just by the U.S., but by all the international community. That kind of money has just not come in. People's hearts and minds and people's stomachs have just not been filled. That, I think, has been the real unfortunate issue. The other point is, of course, is the growing lack of security, especially in the south of the country, and the refusal of the international peacekeeping forces who are in Kabul alone to actually spread out and try and provide some security around the country to aid agencies. People were not expecting the Americans to take the lead in providing troops, but they were expecting the Americans to take the lead in providing the initiative to get other countries to provide troops. And that hasn't happened either.
Ahmed, if this trend isn't turned around, what is at risk here?
I think it's a very, very dangerous situation. The fact is that both Pakistan and Afghanistan are riddled with Islamic extremism. They retreated temporarily, I think, these groups after the war in Afghanistan, after 9/11, but they're very much back. And with the U.S. preoccupation in Iraq right now and very little international attention being focused on Afghanistan, I think the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, these Pakistani extremist groups are all seeing an opportunity now to set up base once again in Afghanistan.
Is there a lesson here for U.S. efforts in Iraq?
Well, what we've seen so far in Iraq is a very similar sad tale of a failure in post-war planning for reconstruction and a political strategy. The last few months have been chaotic because the Americans had no post-war plan in Iraq. Unfortunately, that situation is true for Afghanistan too, or was right after the war ended nearly 2 years ago. I think the lessons are very strongly that you need a very effective economic and political strategy to go alongside a military strategy.
Ahmed, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ahmed Rashid is a reporter for the Far Eastern Economic Review. He spoke with me from Lahore, Pakistan. Intense fighting over the past week in Afghanistan signals that nearly 2 years after Washington's opening salvos in the war on terror, the Taliban may be back in the saddle. If it is, what does that say about the U.S. strategy in fighting terrorism? Are U.S. troops nation-building in Afghanistan or going through the motions while the Taliban nation rebuilds around them? Does the United States have the stamina to go the distance in Afghanistan and Iraq? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Baghdad is Michael Ware, foreign correspondent for Time magazine. He recently spent a week with Taliban forces along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. Good evening and welcome, Michael Ware.
Good evening.
It's great to have you with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Michael Ware, we've heard you check in from Afghanistan before. You were there some weeks ago now, in July, as I understand, and I'm sure you've been watching since from Baghdad. Pakistan, we're reading just today in the Washington Post, says, we have this under control. We are not supporting the Taliban. We're putting the squeeze on them. Did you see evidence that Pakistan has cracked down on the Taliban?
Absolutely not. In fact, I saw very clear evidence of quite the contrary. I saw members of the Taliban, Afghan Taliban, who have taken refuge or found sanctuary back in Pakistan since the US-led war in Afghanistan 2 years ago. Many of these people, when I was speaking to them, were saying that 1 year ago we were dispersed, we were hiding, we had to take to the shadows. Which was true. When I visited them last year, I had to be smuggled from Afghanistan into Pakistan and then meet them in secret at safe houses with a very, very low profile. This time, however, it was a markedly different story. The Taliban are out and proud. They're bold. They're daring. The signature black and white turbans are out on the streets in the cities of southern Pakistan. As one of the Talibs said to me, we had to hide, but now we can go anywhere, we can do anything, because we have the support of Pakistan.
Michael Ware, paint this picture for us geographically. Where did you travel most recently among the Taliban? In what kind of settings did you find them? And what were they up to? What were their goals?
The border between Pakistan and Afghanistan is long and in most parts mountainous. It's divided into two large sections, a northern half and a southern half. To the north, the regions bordering Afghanistan are the northwest frontier provinces. There, Islamic hardline Pakistani groups hold power in the provincial government. These people are more than sympathetic to the Taliban. To the south, in the area of Balochistan, these same hardline Islamic groups hold many seats in the local government as well. Where I travelled was in this southern half. This is in the provincial capital of Quetta and all the way to the border region inside Pakistan and the town of Chaman. These areas are directly across the border from the city of Kandahar in Afghanistan, from where the Taliban originally sprang. It is their stronghold, their heartland. Now, in Quetta itself, there are large sections of the city that now form Afghan quarters. They have for decades. It's where many Afghan refugees have gone and set up new homes and new lives. Throughout these quarters, the Afghans who were hiding, the Talibs who were underground a year ago, are now very, very visible. They're in the streets, they're in the bazaars, they're in the mosques. Their graffiti litters the walls throughout large sections of Quetta. Their propaganda is openly for sale in the market. Audio tapes from Taliban mullahs, from Mullah Omar, the grand commander, the grand leader himself. They're having great congregations, conventions. Whilst I was in Quetta, there was a large convention of Afghan Taliban. The event itself was a graduation, for want of a better term, of new Afghan mullahs who had completed their seminary studies. There was hundreds of young Talibs present.
Michael Ware, stand by there in Baghdad. We want the rest of your report from Baghdad, and Jack Beattie, hang with us as well. We'll be right back after a short break. We are talking tonight about the return of the Taliban and to return to battle in post-war Afghanistan. You can join the conversation. A year ago, people were saying post-war Afghanistan should be a model for Iraq. What kind of model is this? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Brooke, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about the return of the Taliban, about backsliding on the first front in the war on terror. Our guest tonight is Michael Ware with Time Magazine. He recently spent a week with the Taliban, mostly in Pakistan, along the Afghan border, a bit over into Afghanistan. You can join this conversation as well tonight. Can you believe that the once famously vanquished Taliban is now on the comeback trail? And if it is, what does that say about U.S. strategy in fighting terror, about U.S. progress in that war? Could you have imagined in December 2001 that in 2003 you'd be hearing about a Taliban rebirth? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beattie, we're going to get a lot more detail from Michael Ware, but I want to get your thoughts on what we're witnessing here. In fairness, Ahmed Rashid says 1,000 Taliban fighters in Afghanistan. That is hardly what there was there in the fall of 2000. And yet we hear from Michael Ware, a robust rebirth right across the border and increasingly with great fierce battles in the last week and two, back and active in Afghanistan.
Yes, Afghanistan is a paradigm of the limits of American power and a parable about it. Power is the capacity to overawe your enemies and persuade your friends. Well, in Afghanistan, our enemies are back. We're unable to persuade the Pakistanis to stop allowing them to recruit there. We're unable to persuade the Pakistanis to stop terrorism in Kashmir. In Iraq, we can't protect the UN, the mosques, the embassies, the police stations, the members of our new governing council. They're afraid of assassination. And, of course, we can't protect our soldiers. In the Middle East, we can't persuade our friend Abbas to crack down on Hamas. We can't persuade Sharon to stop the settlements. We can't overawe the Syrians. We can't frighten the Iranians out of their nukes. We can't persuade the Saudis to stop spreading hatred with Wahhabism. We couldn't persuade the Turks before the war. Yet President Bush, and of course we couldn't persuade anybody in the world except Tony Blair to join us in the war, yet President Bush said yesterday, America leads the world. Well, look around. Look behind you, Mr. President. Ain't nobody there except Dick Cheney and Tony Blair.
Well, there's a few. There may be a few more, but clearly we are having some trouble bringing this whole huge passel of people to heel. Michael Ware, what about this notion of overawing? There are still about 10,000 troops in Afghanistan. Some have been taken out to Iraq, we're told, but still many there, heavily equipped, aggressively going after the Taliban in the last week or two. Does the Taliban look overawed to you?
Certainly not, in no way. You have to understand, Afghanistan is roughly the size of France. It's mountainous and it's impenetrable. 10,000 troops disappear in Afghanistan with no trouble at all. It's simply not enough to cover the country in any serious way. They can barely control the capital, Kabul, let alone the region surrounding it, and let alone these border areas that have become very active combat zones for the Taliban.
Michael, the Taliban once seemed terrifically important because they were famously the hosts to al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda training camps, the same group that bombed the Twin Towers and the rest of it on 9/11. If they may be back and active, but are they supporting al-Qaeda, this global terrorist network? And if they're not, what does it matter if the Taliban is active?
Well, sadly, the evidence is showing that, yes, they are still supporting al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is in Pakistan. And in fact, you'll find the northern half of the Afghan-Pakistan border. The combat, the fighting, the resistance to the American forces is largely being directed in the north by al-Qaeda itself, by foreign soldiers, by foreign fighters, by foreign experts. There are al-Qaeda camps in the northern half of the border areas. American intelligence knew where they were last year. I had intelligence officers saying to me, here are the camps, here are the satellite pictures. There's three that they'd identified. They simply couldn't touch them. Al-Qaeda could not operate in these Pashtun areas without at least the implicit, if not active, support and of the Taliban, having them speak for them, vouch for them in these strong Pashtun areas.
Okay, so the Taliban is active again. They're taking a lot of fire from U.S. troops in the last couple of weeks, but returning a lot of fire, too. But they're far from in control in Kabul. How do you see, from talking with them, what's the Taliban's goal now? Does it imagine it can retake Afghanistan, or is it just going to be a new criminal, terrorist, fundamentalist subculture along that Afghan-Pakistan border?
Well, there is this fantasy among some of the younger, more naive recruits that somehow, someday soon, there will be a new Taliban government. I mean, these young men, some of them kids, but these young men are deluding themselves into thinking that there will be a new Taliban regime within the next year. Perhaps not over all of Afghanistan, but certainly in large sections of it, in the south, east, and the southwest. The more level-headed, battle-hardened veterans, many of them now the mid-ranking or senior commanders of the Taliban, are saying that what they want to do is harass and interdict the U.S. forces, destabilize this, what they call the puppet regime of Karzai, and they want to see it tumble, Afghanistan return to a state of chaos, which they know will only serve their benefits. They'll be able to move in and capitalize again and at least take over large swathes of their former heartland.
Back to chaos. It doesn't sound good. Michael Ware, stand by. I want to welcome our callers. Brian's calling from Darlington, Wisconsin. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Good program, as always.
Thanks.
Supposedly, Bush put together such a vaunted foreign policy team, and it seems to me that anybody with any common sense would have realized that the relationship that a lot of the people in Pakistan had with the Taliban government and al-Qaeda leaders would have seen the ability of al-Qaeda and the Taliban government when the U.S. invaded to just fade away into the bordering regions of Pakistan. Now, Bush's supposed defense team and military people that he appointed should have basically ran an encircling movement along the border between Pakistan and not relied so heavily on the Northern Alliance to do our fighting for us.
So you're saying if it would have been, this is the same argument in a way about the weight of troops brought in. If the Pentagon had brought in more troops, it might have crushed the Taliban right there and not left a remnant that could grow again?
Well, not only that, but I think Bush had his sights set on Iraq more so than Afghanistan, and I think Afghanistan was basically just a lash out because there was supposed evidence that the Taliban was responsible for 9/11, and Bush had to make a statement about that, but he wanted to do it quick and get out of there, and he realized that the Northern Alliance could do some of our heavy lifting for us, but not enough, which we found out recently, and he wanted to move on from that as quickly as he could and get his feet established in Iraq.
So I hear you saying had to go in, but should have gone in heavier to take care of this problem. I wonder just exactly how it might have been taken care of. Michael Ware, stand by in Baghdad. I want to welcome you to our conversation now from Omaha, Nebraska, Thomas Gutierrez. He's Dean of International Studies and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. He's been in Afghanistan four times in the last year. Good evening and welcome, Thomas Gutierrez.
Nice to be with you again.
It's good to have you back. What are we to make of what we're hearing tonight? We went in almost 2 years ago. The United States did. There was a huge effort there, large expense, and great trumpets of victory. What do you make of this talk of the Taliban being back? A, do you believe it? And B, what's the significance of it?
Well, it is certainly the case. And it is also significant. I don't see it so much as a rebirth as a kind of reappearance of people who were hoping that the reconstruction of Afghanistan would not proceed so effectively that they would be left in the distant memory of other Afghans. In fact, because of the lawlessness that is in Afghanistan, because of the failure to meet the expectations of Afghans in the reconstruction activities, And because we really haven't put in the effort in Afghanistan that is required, a Marshall Plan kind of effort, the whole effort in Afghanistan runs the risk of turning up a failure. And that's most unfortunate because that was the first battle of the war against terrorism. It is the one that everybody is following and is the one that is, I think, even more critical than what is going on in Iraq towards our hopes for ensuring that this war on terrorism is a success.
Well, it's nearly 2 years now. At what point do you say this is a failure, or at what point does it have the consequences of failure, whatever you call it?
Well, I don't think we've reached that point yet, but what we have failed to do is come up with a concerted, well-coordinated plan in Afghanistan. We didn't have the luxury, as we did in Iraq, of developing a plan for the period after the war because we were attacked on the 11th of September and we had to move quickly, which we did do. But we then went into this type of plan, which I refer to as the donor conference plan, where you have nations from all around coming on very expensive trips to various cities to pledge certain amounts of money. What that does not lead to a well-coordinated plan. In fact, it leads to just the opposite, a very fragmented plan, and with monies that come in very fragmented periods as well, anywhere from immediate to 5 years down the road. And because of the fact that this plan has not proceeded well, because we have not taken the Marshall Plan type of definitive leadership in Afghanistan, unlike what we're trying to do in Iraq, we've left in Afghanistan a real gap, a real vacuum in leadership and in coordination. And we still have a chance to turn that around. We have a new ambassador. The other one was good, but he didn't have the resources. The new one, Zalmai Khalilzad, of course, was originally born in Afghanistan, has the advantages of the languages and the knowledge of the culture. We need to take advantage of this opportunity and the commitment to provide rapid response kinds of assistance to the Afghans, so that the Afghan citizenry knows that we are sincere in our commitment, like we showed in 1989 when we pulled out after the Soviets did.
Mm-hmm. Thomas Gutierrez, stand by, and Michael Ware. I want to continue to welcome our callers in because there are a lot who want to join us. Kumar is calling from Boston. Hi, Kumar. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to elaborate on one or two points on what your speakers have said. And one of the things that bothers me is this kind of uniform view of the Taliban. Some of the Pakistani view is that the Taliban is multicultural in the sense that they make up a number of groups. Sometimes we just view them as misogynist religious fanatics who export drugs. But from the Pakistani perspective, there are a number of social services and a number of groups that are dedicated to helping orphans and helping feeding the poor, at least in Pakistan. And the Taliban had their hand in this type of work. And I think this is missed out in the equation when you're speaking about eradicating Taliban.
Well, Kumar, if you're still there, I mean, that of course, societies need hospitals, so the Taliban build hospitals. But they also gave a home to al-Qaeda, and we saw what came from that. So are you saying let's hold hands with the Taliban now?
No, of course not. It's not always that black and white. I'm saying that there is a whole white-collar group of people who turned to the Taliban, who are engineers and doctors and lawyers themselves, mm-hmm. and found no other avenue to be productive on the border of Pakistan and in Afghanistan in the post-Taliban period. And now, to them, I think, from my friends and relatives who live in the area, tell me that this is the only source where they can recapture any sense of remaking an Afghanistan that is theirs, that is from their own cultural history.
Well, why not simply go back to Afghanistan and work with the government of Afghan President Hamid Karzai?
you're absolutely right. And I think Ahmed Rashid had pointed out that there are tons and tons of ethnic rivalries and histories of of separation. But that's not the only answer. I think one of the problems is being isolated and being a part of a particular ethnic or tribal group does not allow you to penetrate the current political system that's set up. And so from what I hear and what I read, people are using the Taliban, which is multi-partied in this phase, to really come back and regroup as a different type of group. It's not the old Taliban.
We hear the nuance you're putting on it. I have to admit, it's hard to get one's head completely around, but we appreciate your raising it. Michael Ware, how about it? Do you see a strain of frustrated do-gooders among the Taliban that you saw in Pakistan?
What I'm seeing is the Taliban capitalizing on great schisms within Afghanistan itself at the moment. The Pashtun ethnic group, which is the largest group within Afghanistan, is certainly being, if not excluded from the reins of power in Afghanistan, they're being sidelined to some degree. They don't hold the real reins of power in Kabul. This is an affront to them. They feel alienated. The Taliban is really making the most of this. They know that striking these themes hits a chord with the Pashtuns in the south and the Pashtuns who have either fled to Pakistan or have migrated to Pakistan. It also resonates with the Pashtuns of Pakistan. So they're able to whip up all kinds of sentiments. Now, whilst that may attract people who genuinely want to help, who see the Taliban as perhaps one of the few active vehicles right now, that is not the essence of the Taliban movement that we are seeing now. The essence of this Taliban movement is military. They have reformed into battle commands. They have regrouped their troops. They're out to destabilize Afghanistan. And the Afghanistan they want to recreate may not be that much better than what we'd seen before. Some of these Taliban clerics that I spoke to in Pakistan were saying, we don't need economic progress. We don't need development. The only thing we need is the development of Islam. And by that, they mean the development of their particular brand of Islam. Mm.
Jack Beatty, let me turn to you. It sounds again as though here, if the United States doesn't get way ahead of the curve on redevelopment, it ends up spending that money anyway, potentially on years of military struggle.
Yes, but you know, I mean, the truth of it is we break nations. We don't put them together again. And this administration especially is averse to that. And they have never had any interest in doing what needed to be done in Afghanistan. And they have just sort of pushed it off onto NGOs and the UN or whoever can do it. But the idea that we're going to somehow make a long-term Marshall Plan commitment to this remote nation, I just think is not on the cards, certainly not from this administration.
But those were almost President Bush's words, and it sounds as though tonight a lot rides on that. Jack, stand by. Thomas Gutierrez, Michael Ware, we're talking tonight about the return of the Taliban and Afghanistan once again hanging in the balance. You can join the conversation. Are U.S. troops nation-building or retreating while the Taliban nation rebuilds around them? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Support for this program. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the return of the Taliban and a return to battle in post-war Afghanistan. Can you believe that the famously vanquished Taliban is now on a comeback trail? What's the lesson in that resurgence for Washington, for the United States? When you break a country, you've got to stay and fix it. And does the United States have the stamina to go the distance in Afghanistan, in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Thomas Gutierrez, Dean of International Studies at University of Nebraska, Omaha, with us tonight, as well as Michael Ware, Time Magazine correspondent, recently in Pakistan and Afghanistan with the Taliban, joining us tonight from Baghdad. Thomas Gutierrez, how do you read Pakistan's interests in all this? Why this continued support for the Taliban?
Well, the situation in Pakistan is so complex, and the strength of the fundamentalist, the extreme fundamentalist groups, is so strong because they receive so much money from outside of Pakistan, from the Wahhabi interests in the Persian Gulf and in Saudi Arabia, that it's very hard for the government, even if it was 100% committed towards doing so, to really get a handle on all this. There's a lot of political support inside Pakistan for these extremist groups because it's all tied in as well to the Pakistani psyche and its paranoia relating to India and the relationship over the Kashmir issues. So it's a very, very complicated thing. So it's not something that Musharraf can, turn on or shut off at the drop of the hat.
And if Washington should increase the pressure on Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf, if they should bring the hammer down, whatever that means, first, can they? And if they did, could he deliver? Could the government of Pakistan change things here?
Well, I think if we provided the kinds of support, one of the things that always happens, unfortunately, with these kinds of very important initiatives is that we always, because it's the way democratic societies proceed, try to do it as cheaply as we can, on the cheap. And when you try and do something on the cheap, you always wind up doing it piecemeal. And when you wind up doing it piecemeal, it never works, and you always wind up then having to muddle through for a long period of time.
But there's been something like
this with Afghanistan. And when I say we're in that cycle with Afghanistan, we're also in that cycle with Pakistan because the policy in Afghanistan requires us to be working very closely with Pakistan as well because of the reasons that we've been discussing throughout this particular program. And because Pakistan itself has its own very, very serious problems, particularly in the gap in the economy and those who have and those who don't, that make it a very strong breeding ground for just those people who are going back into Afghanistan now, as we're discussing.
I'm just not hearing that cork that was to be put here into the bottle of chaos to take away that realm that the Al-Qaeda threat originally grew out of. It's disturbing. Jordan's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jordan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I think what I'm concerned about as I listen to this discussion is there seems to be an assumption that if, for example, we built every Afghani a new house, made sure all their children were inoculated, everybody had health care, basically provided a good life, provided alternatives to these poppy growers and so on, that somehow change the effectiveness of the
Jordan, your cell phone is breaking up on us, but I think we've got the point, and I want to put it to our guests, and Thomas Gutierrez, to you first. Jordan says, come on, guys, you could build houses all over Afghanistan, inoculate everybody, build new schools, and still have no guarantee that this would work out. How do you respond to that?
That's not what the Afghans are seeking right now. What really is needed is to try and bring Afghanistan back to where it was in 1973, before this tremendous downslide in its fortunes began. And what is required is not that type of effort, which, is not realistic. But what Afghans need is the stability, which they haven't had for 30 years. They need the chance to develop and build their own economy, which they haven't had for 30 years. All these things that every nation has had for 30 years, when Afghanistan has been without a government, it has become a state without a state, without that government, and it has not been able to take advantage of moving into the modern era. And
so you're saying nothing fancy, but the basics that would allow them to have what we could imagine as a country, a nation.
That's right. I mean, it was doing that in the 60s and 70s, Afghanistan, in fact, was among the most progressive countries in that part of the world, and was trying with a democratic experiment to move into a parliamentary form of government, more so than the countries that surround it. But now, of course, after 30 years, it's destitute. It looks like Dresden after the Second World War. So we don't need to conceive of ideas that are going to put every, a chicken in every pot kind of thing in Afghanistan. We just need to help the Afghans reconstruct those fundamental elements of the of the foundations of their society so that they can themselves begin to move forward. And there's no stability in the country right now for them to do that. That's the first thing we have to get, stability through security.
But that's what U.S. forces are supposed to do. And beyond that, you mentioned the donor conference. Haven't there been something like $6 billion earmarked for Afghanistan? That sounds like a lot.
Yes, but about $250 million have been delivered because of reasons that we've been talking about, that you make these pledges, but it takes up to 5 years for delivery. Plus, a lot of these things are pledged by organizations that or by countries who hire organizations who don't have that experience and who cost an awful lot to put into Afghanistan. So what you have is a situation where there's a kind of gridlock in terms of the presence of international aid organizations all seeking to become active in this. You got automobile vehicular gridlock, and you have personnel gridlock, and you don't have coordination. And,
it doesn't sound like a good picture. Michael Ware, I want to come back to you and that picture of the Taliban regrouping, reemerging in that dusty badlands along the Afghan border. Give us some more of the look and feel of that. What's the graffiti say? What are their hopes? How successful do they feel they're being? And what do they think about the American military on the other side of the border that greet them when they come across?
Well, these re-emerging Taliban see the American military as nothing more than foreign invaders who aren't only attacking their country, but are attacking their belief systems, their religion. Obviously, this isn't necessarily the case, but that's how it very easily comes across and translates to them. I mean, what they're doing is they have recruited again with great force and great speed and great effect. You now have Taliban commanders who are in charge of what they describe as battalions, and they'll set up four or five houses in Pakistan where they will put 20, 30, 40 men in each house. Each one of these men gets right to live here only if he agrees to fight. And there's no shortage of these houses. Afghan refugees were complaining to me that the rental market had been pushed up because there were so many of these commanders with so much money ready to set up these establishments. What they're doing is then raiding across the border, willy-nilly, attacking the very fabric of this new Karzai-led government.
And if military power is increasingly turned over to an Afghan army, does that make things better or worse? That's the long-term goal.
It is the long-term goal, and at the end of the day, it's the only solution. That it's the only exit strategy that Washington can possibly hope for, is to have a real and effective and bristling national Afghan army. But this is coming along in very, very small steps. It's a necessary part of the frustrating process. But for the time being, while this new Afghan army remains ineffective, it remains just a hollow shell that can only be used in very, very small capacities, you have the Taliban with a brand new strategy that's been developed in the last 3 months. They were talking about it with me. Now we're seeing it play on the ground. They know that attacking U.S. forces is a no-brainer, that there's no way they can overwhelm U.S. forces. So what they've been doing is attacking every representative, every way in which the Karzai government shows its face in the south. Border posts, police stations, Afghan NGOs, even pro-government mullahs. I mean, in the last 40 days or 50 days, four pro-government mullahs have been assassinated in Kandahar.
Michael Ware, with that, it sounds as though the Taliban and the Afghanistan situation are almost resonating right off of Iraq. It's always great hearing from you, Michael, and thank you so much for joining us tonight from Baghdad.
It's always my pleasure.
Michael Ware is a correspondent with Time Magazine, recently spent a week with the Taliban. His article on that visit is in this week's Time Magazine. And Thomas Gutierrez at the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, thank you so much for being with us.
Nice to be with you again.
Jack Beatty, I don't like the echoes I hear between these two countries right now and the resistance there. It's almost as though one's learning from the other, maybe evolving more rapidly than the American counterpose.
Yes, and but what both situations have in common, it seems to me, is what Senator Fulbright years ago called the arrogance of American power. The idea that somehow we were just going to come in there, get rid of the government, and everything would be fine, and we'd spend a few million dollars maybe, and it'll all work out. Or the idea that we could go into Iraq without any plan for the post-war, the arrogance of power.
Well, there will be a lot more to see to, maybe to answer for. Jack, stand by for a moment. In a moment, John Kerry makes his run for the presidency official. This is On Point. With the USS Yorktown as his background, Massachusetts Democratic Senator John Kerry officially announced his candidacy for president earlier today. Focusing on his own record as a war hero, Kerry attacked George W. Bush on a front where the president once seemed untouchable, Bush's performance as a wartime president. George Bush's vision does not live up to the America I enlisted in the Navy to defend, Kerry said. I will challenge George Bush for fundamentally taking our country in the wrong direction. Here are excerpts from that speech.
George Bush has led and misled us on a course at odds with 200 years of our history. He has squandered the goodwill of the world after September 11th, and he has lost the respect and the influence that we need to make our country safe. We are seeing the peril in Iraq every day. I voted to threaten the use of force to make Saddam Hussein comply with the resolutions of the United Nations. I believe that was right. But it was wrong to rush to war without building a true international coalition and with no plan to win the peace. So long as Iraq remains an American intervention and not an international undertaking, we will face increasing danger and mounting casualties. Being flown to an aircraft carrier and saying, "Mission accomplished," doesn't end a war. And the swagger of a president saying, "Bring 'em on," will never bring peace or safety to our troops. Pride is no substitute for protecting our young men and women in uniform. Half the names on the Vietnam Memorial are there because of pride, because of a president who refused to admit we're on the wrong road, that we might be wrong. Pride is no excuse for making enemies overseas. It is time to return to the United Nations, not with the arrogance of Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, but with genuine respect.
Senator John Kerry officially announcing his presidency for president earlier today. Jack Beatty, throwing arrogance and pride in the face of the president. Is this rhetoric a ladder to the White House?
Well, it's the latter he's going to use. He's got a dilemma. He cast the wrong vote in last October. He voted, he said, to enable the president to get to build a coalition. It was a green light to war. Everyone knew it. And he voted wrong, I mean, politically. This is why Howard Dean is beating him by 21 points in New Hampshire today. And that his rest of his campaign is going to be trying to find a way to dig himself out of the political hole, at least with Democratic primary voters, he dug when he voted for the war.
And if Dean and Kerry are going to go head and head, they are the front runners at this point, do you think Dean's going to hang that around his neck? And will that work if he does?
He will hang it around his neck, and Wesley Clark will also hang it around his neck when he enters in September 19th. It's going to be a tough time, I think, for John Kerry.
Much to sort out on that front. Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program.